Welcome to Satsang Conversations, where we journey across the world to the serene and sacred spaces of BAPS Mandirs. This podcast is your gateway to exploring profound spiritual lessons that echo through time, yet remain incredibly relevant to our everyday lives. Each episode brings heartfelt discussions, wisdom, and insights that help us navigate the challenges of modern life with a deeper sense of peace, purpose, and connection. So whether you're seeking inspiration, solace, or a spark to light up your spiritual path, join us as we dive into conversations that uplift the soul and enrich the heart. This week, we travel to Neasden, UK, to the BAPS Mandir in London, where we'll be joining a conversation with Pujya Param Tattva Swami and Pujya Tyagaratna Swami on the Vachanamrit.
Swami, thank you for joining us today. Param Tattva Swami and Pujya Tyagaratna Swami. I think today's Vachanamrit that we're going to talk about is actually quite an interesting one. It's one of those Vachanamrits where when you first read it, you may not think it applies to you, right? But then I think as we go into it and discuss it, it becomes really relevant. And that's Pratham 20. It talks a lot about the Atma, the Jeev, and knowing oneself, and maybe focusing where you shouldn't be focusing. It's a very interesting question. I don't know, Yogamitibha, if you wanted to read that out to start off with.
Yeah, sure. Happy to read it. And I think, like you said, I'm definitely one of those people who read this. I read it a number of times. And until, to be honest, I was thinking about it for this discussion, I didn't realize how many layers there were. So really looking forward to getting your views, something yours as well. So I guess let's get into it.
Yeah,
we'll start reading.
Sure.
So I'm not going to read the whole thing. I think we'll take parts at a time just so we can digest it and discuss it. So it begins, "Then Swami Sri Sahajananji Maharaj said, 'Please listen, I wish to ask all of you a question.' Hearing this, all of the devotees said, with folded hands, 'Please do ask.' Thereupon Sriji Maharaj asked, 'Who is the most ignorant of all ignorant people?' Everyone pondered over the question, but no one was able to reply. So Sriji Maharaj said, 'Here, I shall answer myself.'" And before we go into his answer, one thing I wanted to just ask you was, clearly they couldn't answer his question. It was a very deep question. Why didn't he just preach? Why did he actually ask a question in the first place?
I think that's very interesting. And I think
and before we say Swami, what's Maharaj himself, even though he's Bhagwan,
yeah,
and the people in front of him consider him to be Bhagwan, he asks,
"Yes,
I want to ask, can I wish to ask you a question? Will you allow me to ask a question?"
Yeah.
Such a founder's point.
So even the framing of those words is so polite and humble. He's not there to preach or to like look down upon them, like, this is what you're doing wrong, this is what you need to do right. I think even from just that first line, there's so much to take away about parenting, about your relationship with, say, your an employer or an employee. Spouses, how you speak to each other. There's a lot to learn from here. And yeah, I think it's fascinating that he's not just come in with a set script. Okay, today I'm going to talk about this, right? You know, he could easily have done that. Today's lecture is about this. He's not a professor. He's there. There is a relationship. As soon as he's made it into a dialogue, he's asking a question. He's seeing what the response may be. And it's actually fine.
Why is he doing that? Do you think there's another level to why he's seeing what the notice is, or do you think there's it's just more the politeness and
no? I don't think it's not just a polite gesture. I think there's more to that. There is, because there are other Vachanamrits where the Paramahansas or even the Haribhaktas, they have attempted an answer. Sometimes they're right, like he will accept that answer, that's correct, and he'll expand upon that. Sometimes he will say, well, that's not the full answer. And he'll give a much more comprehensive response to that question. The fact here that he's actually willing or receptive enough to receive responses from other people, I think that immediately makes, first of all, the audience more attentive. Like, okay, if someone's asking me a question, I have an opportunity to respond. And on this point also, the fact that they can't, saying I don't know is a legitimate answer. I think that can be just as intellectual to say, I don't know. That's a reasonable, intellectual, valid answer, rather than waffling or trying to make yourself look more intelligent in front of your mates, you know, like, oh, I'm going to answer that question, right? If you don't know the answer, that's a sign of eagerness to learn. Like, actually, that's a wonderful question. I don't know the answer. I want to learn.
Do you think that, considering how many years the Paramahansas have been with Sriji Maharaj, they wouldn't know the answer? I'm just, they could be that maybe they do know the answer, but they want to hear it from him. And so they'll raise their hands and say, look, we don't know the answer. And maybe they want Bhagwan to answer the question, to hear it from himself directly. That could be.
That's a very good
Yeah, because you have Muktananda Swami, Nityananda Swami, Brahmananda Swami there.
Though this is early on in that kind of discourse journey.
So 76.
Yes.
And a good how many years before?
This is about 10 years before Maharaj passes away. Yeah.
And 15 years into Maharaj has come into lodge.
Yeah.
So this is quite a few years.
Yeah, so I'm sure he's talked about this many ways. But I thought, again, the way he frames the question then is very interesting as well. Can you just repeat the question?
Sure. So the question asked is, who is the most ignorant of all ignorant people?
Ah, yes.
Strong question.
Yeah. Ignorant, of the ignorant.
Yeah. So that to me also, like, he could have asked plain, like, who's the most ignorant of all? That's what he's actually asking. But by framing it in a way that there is, like, this whole pool of ignorant people, and of those, who is the most ignorant, right? It kind of raises the stakes a bit, like, okay, this has just made it a bit more interesting. So even that, how you frame your questions, it's lots to learn from you, and how you ask the right question, you're going to get a much more precise answer.
So when he's referring to the pool of ignorant people, is that referring to, who do you think he's referring to there? Because is it everyone? Or is it just certain people, do you think, Swami? I don't know, it's quite interesting. Now that you raised that, I didn't actually notice that before.
Yeah, so knowing now where the discussion is going and coming back to it, you know, I see that he's asked the question, the topic is knowledge, right? When you ask somebody who is ignorant, someone who lacks knowledge. So the topic is knowledge now. So how much do you know? So Yogamurti, you're a chartered accountant, right? How much do you know in your field? Right, that's a question, right? And equally, I mean, you have to answer that question, all right? So that's a sensitive question, I guess. But even besides, so okay, you're a chartered accountant. You could be the best chartered accountant. But that doesn't mean you know how to build a bridge, right? That's a structural engineer. You haven't studied structural engineering. You've studied, you know, accounting. I could ask a structural engineer, you know, who has built, you know, the Eiffel Tower or, you know, Tower Bridge, but he or she wouldn't know how to conduct, say, cardiovascular surgery. That's a surgeon. Each is a stream of knowledge. Now, if we take the expanse of all the streams of knowledge, it's physically impossible for one person to gain all that knowledge, even within their own field, that you could have a surgeon just focusing, not knowing the whole body even, just say the eye or the ear or the nose. Even within that, there is just an endless amount of knowledge. So, relatively speaking, we're all ignorant to a certain extent. Now, this is what actually, this is what I feel is like the clincher. If what you know doesn't make you knowledgeable, by not knowing it, doesn't make you ignorant.
So repeat that.
I'll say that again, okay. So you're a chartered accountant, or whoever you are, right, in your own field. If what you know doesn't make you fully knowledgeable, someone who might not know it doesn't make them ignorant.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Right, so I don't know accountancy, I don't know. There's more things I don't know that I know. In fact, what I know is minuscule, right, for everybody. But that doesn't necessarily make me ignorant. What does make me ignorant is what Maharaj is talking about next. So bahya knowledge, knowledge of the outside world, is necessarily going to be limited by my capacity. My intelligence is limited. whereas the pool of knowledge is vast and immense.
This is incredible because it opens it up to, it makes it accessible to anybody.
Correct. Yeah.
You don't need to have a certain level of intellect or exposure or experience based on what you just said.
Yeah, we're all equally ignorant, and yet we have access now to be knowledgeable. We don't, you know, there is no prerequisite to this internal knowledge now.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever had those thoughts when I've read this myself, so it shows the value of discussing it, especially with Swamis as well. Should I read the answer? Shriji Maharaj then began, "The jiv, which resides within the body, observes both the attractive and the unattractive. It witnesses childhood, youth, and old age, as well as a countless number of other things. However, the observer fails to observe its own self. The jiv looks at objects externally, but it does not look at its own self. Therefore, it is the most ignorant of the ignorant." Maharaj continues, "And furthermore, just as the jiv indulges in a countless variety of sights with the eyes, it similarly indulges in and knows the pleasures of the other vishes with the ears, skin, tongue, and nose, but it does not indulge in the bliss of its own self, nor does it know its own nature. For this reason, it is the most ignorant of the ignorant." So I guess there's a lot to unpick in that. Maybe we can start with the jiv, because, you know, the question was, who is the most ignorant? But here in the answer, immediately we hear this term, the jiv. So I don't know, Sandeep, if you can explain the Swamis, if you want to explain what the jiv is.
Well, I think an interesting point, just to go back to your ignorant, the most ignorant point. Again, to ask the question, is he, I know you're saying it's accessible to everyone, is Maharaj specifically here referring to people on the spiritual path?
To anyone. Based on the second paragraph, it opens up to everybody and anyone.
Because everyone has
a soul. Level of ignorance.
Yeah, and everybody has a soul, has a Jew. Yeah, this is universal wisdom, right? This is what makes it so accessible and relevant to everybody beyond time, beyond geography, beyond ethnicity, even beyond faith. Everyone, every living being is accessible to this knowledge now.
That's a good point, because what Maharaj is saying there is that the jiv looks at, or people, let's just say, you know, people, you may maybe not be on the spiritual path, right? So people have the jiv, maybe they're not aware of it, etc. But they say they look outside for their happiness. They don't look inside for their happiness.
It's very clear. It talks about happiness. Mm. Ultimately, that's what the eventual search is, peace, happiness, whatever you want to call it. And in a nutshell, he's saying we look outside for that happiness instead of within happiness. So in essence, he's saying that happiness is actually latent within us. It's innate.
And I guess just to reiterate, when we say us, I think when Maharaj is speaking here, he's kind of reminding us who we actually are. And I think some of you just touched on in terms of the answer to the question, in terms of what the jiv is. You mentioned soul. Yeah. Is it worth just recapping on that just for, so we're clear?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is something, the living spirit within, which is eternal, undying. It is the spiritual element which enlivens all of ourselves. Like, you see a dead body and we see us, what's the difference? There is something missing there. That missing thing that brings something to life, which allows us to see, allows us to hear, allows us to feel. All those experiences are embedded because of that living spirit. That is the soul. The consciousness which that provides is what the soul is. And I think in all of this, Maharaj is urging us to look towards that. That is who we are. That is our true identity. And yet we're so fixated and caught up in our exterior kind of, you know, modes. Yeah, and that we lose sight of who we really are. And that actually is the cause of unhappiness and despair.
And so I guess I've always been confused. Is there a difference between the term jiva and atma? Or is the jiva the one that's bound to the mic sense, and that was the pure?
So yeah, some people do make that distinction, that the jiva is the atma with maya. surrounded by it, veiled by Maya, and Atma is the pure Maya, Atma.
Jeev veiled with ignorance.
Jeev
with ignorance.
Ignorance, yeah. But I think in the Vajramat, when we study the Vajramat, Maharaj does use it interchangeably.
Okay, that's actually...
No, but I think what you mentioned regarding the identity of Atma and realizing the potential or the characteristics of Atma, it brings a lot into light. The Atma is very powerful. It is innately happy. It is indestructible. Obviously, Sri Krishna Bhagavan said in the Gita, even Maharaj has mentioned in the Vajramrita. So all these qualities of the Atma, realizing that, if we are able to tap into that, you're happy. Because the Atma is innately happy.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll come to that a bit more further down as well. But when we're talking about the Atma, as you just mentioned as well, like what Maharaj is trying to say is that we're looking out, but instead, why don't we look in? And that's where we find the Atma.
So is that, that's introspection?
Yes, in a way, yeah. Introspection, literally, like looking within. Yeah.
So, okay, fine.
So, but looking within and identifying
yourself
as Atma.
Yeah.
When you introspect, it's this is what I'm reading into. When you introspect, you're actually looking within and identifying yourself as Atma rather than the physical.
Yeah. It's I remember there's a nice parable that sometimes we share about talking about realizing the Atma. It's a nice way of understanding this distinction. So like imagine a classroom, right? There's a teacher and she's asking all the the pupils, like, what color is an apple? Simple question, right? Young kids, 4, 5, 6, whatever. What color is an apple? And what would you expect? All the hands shot up, right? Somebody said red, right? Yeah. You got a red apple?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, okay, good. Another hand, few hands were still up, right? Another color of an apple?
Green,
correct, right. Most hands were down, right? I don't think there really are many other colors up, but maybe yellow? Yeah, maybe yellow, okay. But there's one boy, he still had his hand up, right? So the teacher asked the boy, like, you want to go to the bathroom or something? He goes, no, I want to ask you a question. I want to answer your question. He goes, no, but we've had all our answers, right? Apples are either red or green or perhaps yellow, but, there's no other color. There's no blue or purple apples, right? He goes, no, I think there's another color of an apple. I said, yeah, okay, go on. What color is are you talking about? And he said, apples are white. And everybody started laughing, right? And he said, no, apples aren't white. He goes, yeah, but look inside. Look inside. So you've had a red apple, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What color is it inside?
White.
Why do we call it red? Surely if it's a red apple, you think it'd be red inside, right? But no, it's white. You've had a green apple?
Mm-hmm.
Right. What color is it inside?
White.
Well, we call it green, and the red and the green is literally so superficial, right? It's skin deep.
It's just the outside.
It's skin deep. But all of us, when we go to our core, we're all white. The red apple is white, the green apple is white, the yellow apple is white. So all of us, if we actually penetrate beyond the skin, all of us are that soul. It's the Atma. Can you imagine? It's that, whatever, was it melanin? Right? The skin, the pigment. The type and amount of pigment in our skin which gives us the colors, right? From black, brown, white, and everything in between. We are so fixated on all that. Imagine if we could go beyond that. The amount of blood, sweat, and tears that have been shed because of the amount and type of melanin in your body. The wars, the violence, the hatred, because we can't go beyond what's here. We all bleed red. Even beyond that, if we all realize that we are the soul within, how powerful would that be? So, looking within.
Yeah.
You don't judge anyone.
Yeah, there's no judgment.
There's no judgment here.
There is. And we're actually equal in that sense. It's a level playing field. We're all the soul. There's no ethnicity. There's no caste. There's no gender. There's no nationality. You're beyond all of that. You've immediately transcended, your
your DNA. That means your degrees, your pay packet, your postcode, what phone you, all of that is now immaterial. And immaterial actually is the right word, because we're going spiritual. We're going beyond the material into the spiritual.
So on one hand, we've got this knowledge. And I mean, when you describe it like that, it's like just perfection is a paradise, you know, an existence like that where, you know, we overcome all of these reasons to be unhappy, you know, happiness is within us. So then, but the thing is, we have to use what we have to perceive. So, for example, in here, Maharaj says that we don't know our own nature, but we know through the senses, and all of our senses are pointed outwards. So we know what we feel, you know, through touch, what we see, what we hear. And I guess for that reason, we are inherently focused on what's external. So how, you know, it's difficult. I mean, even if we look at worldly examples, you mentioned earlier, Swami, in terms of the roles we play, various roles we play. So whether it be in a family or at work. Now at work, for example, we play a role, you know, we have a job. And as you know, as introspective, you mentioned the word introspection before, as we think we might be, you can't really know yourself in a professional sense until you have an appraisal, until you ask for feedback, someone to tell you about yourself. So even in a worldly sense, we need that, someone to tell us things. So I guess my point now, and I know that in the discussion we'll get into a bit more, is that it's difficult to know your own nature because we are wired in a way to see things externally. That's why, I guess, in the question, so following Maharaj's answer, the question, counter question that's asked by Shukmuni is that he raises a doubt and he says, is it truly in one's own hands to see one's own self? And if it is, why does the jiva remain ignorant?
Should we just answer the question, actually?
Yeah, so Maharaj answers the question, right? he gives the answer.
Yeah.
It's satsang.
Yeah, he says, you know, for a person who has attained satsang, realization of his jivatma does indeed lie in his own hands. In fact, when has he attempted to see his own self and failed to see it? Having become dependent to and made helpless by Maya, that jiva draws within and enters the dream and deep sleep states, but never does it draw within of its own accord to see its own self.
So there's a key line in there also, which one who has attained satsang, and how you define satsang is also very, it is through satsang that this knowledge is, you know, you said the appraisal and the feedback and the guidance, that's where it comes from. It's through satsang that it comes through.
I'm just thinking of another Vajramad now. I want to read the exact words because it's just a few Vajramads before this. Pratham 16, Gara section 1, number 16. And Maharaj talks about this, and here it is, look. When he accepts whatever words of advice God and the Sant offer as the highest truth, but does not doubt their words in any way, thus, when the Sant tells him, you are distinct from the mind, body, indriyas, and prana, you are satya, and you are the knower of the body, indriyas, and prana, which are all asatya, he accepts this to be the truth. He then behaves as the atma, distinct from all, but never follows the instincts of his own mind. So a key part of that spiritual journey, the process of understanding and going inside, is the Sant. When the Sant tells him and reveals his own self. So as you said, you know, somebody else telling you or appraising you or helping you go, you know, guide that journey, it's the Ekantik Satpurush, the Satpurush who is Akshar Brahm, guiding you to realize your own self.
And I think this is something that we've always heard. Pramukh Sai Maharaj has always used to tell us in his Katha, in his Ashirwad, even Mohan Sai Maharaj constantly, repeatedly reminding us that we are the Atma. And to look beyond just the physical body, Pramukh Sai Maharaj would often, how Atma Gnana actually helps us in day-to-day practice, in day-to-day life. And Swami would often joke about it, but Swami would say that, you know, if somebody insulted you, and, you know, made fun of you in front of everybody and called your name or something. Yeah. You know, you're like a donkey. And that would be so insulting in front of everybody. But Pramukh Sai Maharaj was so dismissive of something like that as well. And he said, well, think about it. Are you really a donkey? You're the Atma. Forget about even the physical body. You're the Atma. The minute you start to realize that, all of a sudden, he just shuts all the other doors, thinking, hang on a minute. Mm. I'm not the donkey. I'm not even this human. I'm not even this body. Mm. I'm beyond that. And automatically, you've deflected all that insult.
It's really interesting, because what that example, putting into context with the Vashavrat, is really powerful, because what Maharaj is saying, if I'm getting this right, is if you try, you can succeed. If you try, because I think that I love that part about Avashambhut. I love the part that when Maharaj says, who hasn't succeeded if they've tried? Mm. To me, that may be a side topic here, but to me, that's Pramukh Swami, hard work plus prayers equals success.
Yeah. Mm.
Right? It's just we haven't tried hard enough. This is probably the hardest thing for any of us on the spiritual path to do, to look and see your jeev and shut out all the outside things. But, you know, I can translate that into everything else in my life. That, you know, if Maharaj is saying someone who really tries will be able to see the Atma, then surely other material things, I mean, obviously career, etc., if I put my full effort into it, I can achieve those.
It applies there too.
Right? I mean, if this can be achieved, anything lower can be achieved as well. So that part I love about that Avashamrut, and I take that away, and it inspires me, I think, quite a bit when I'm facing difficulties.
That's very good, you see. So what we're doing here already through this discussion, and we began from the way Maharaj frames the question and the fact that he asks the question, we're already using these teachings and these techniques for our spiritual journey, but also our kind of holistic journey as well. So there's so much to these Vacharamats that we can actually take away. It's not just, oh, it's just Atmanishtha and very spiritual. Spirituality is practical.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, that's the point.
The point, actually, that was quite interesting. The point I was actually going to make, so I'm sorry to interrupt, was more the point you touched on, Jad, I'm sorry, was what Prabhu Swami said, if you get called a donkey, it's my choice.
To accept it or reject it. Yes.
And that choice, if I read actually this Vachanabrut, is based on the knowledge that I am the Atma. I remember there's a very interesting, there's a book called Shantaram. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's very, the first page was totally interesting, not to talk about it on the book, but in the first page he talks about how this person was effectively being tortured. And he said it was my choice whether to have hatred towards that person, yes, or to forgive him. Mm-hmm. And I think that concept of choice is, when I bring it back to this Vachanamrut, is all about, like you said, the knowledge of the Atma. So then it becomes a knowledge, it becomes a Vachanamrut not about the jeev alone, but it becomes a Vachanamrut about introspection, knowledge of who you are, and then having that choice to be happy, or to take it. Is that what I'm wrong? The light, right?
Yeah. So I think what really makes this a very powerful point now is that what Maharaj is, when he's seeing us as ignorant, he's saying, you know, why is he moving towards this, to this whole approach? We're ignorant, it's like helpless. We are attaching our sukh, our happiness, to everything external, which is bound, is subject to change, right? If I am going to be happy only when I wear this, you know, this jacket, or I get this new phone, or I get this next new promotion, or I eat this, I watch this, I see this, I travel here. If those are my pins, if I pin my happiness on all those external objects and things, I am at the mercy of that.
You're so vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. You're immediately insecure. Because all those things are subject to change. Now, what he's trying to do is wrestle control from those external factors and bring it back inside. When we say independent, right? We're trying to be independent, right? Everybody's, prides themselves on being autonomous or independent. You know, I don't depend on... Independence, I see, is like independent. I'm dependent on my inside. My happiness, this is what Maharaj is trying to explain, is not dependent on, you know, how my coffee is made in the morning, or, you know, what car I'm going to get in. It's inside. Because happiness is inside. And as Diagrat Swami mentioned, we are intrinsically, inherently happy. The soul is Sat, Chit, Anand. It's like it's your very being. If you ask, it's like sugar. If you have sugar, and it's trying to seek sweetness outside of itself. Like, you ask, your sugar, you provide sweetness to everything else. So asking the soul to be happy because of X, Y, and Z outside, you are what's actually intrinsically happy. Sat, Chit, Anand. Sat means truth, literally, but it's existence. You are eternity existence, past, present, and future. Chit means consciousness. It's when we say alive. And so the experience of everything. And Anand, it's Anand Roop. So, isn't that powerful? Yeah. I get to decide, choose, because I am already happy. There's another Vajrayana, Loya 17. Again, very, very powerful. Maharaj explains, nothing outside of yourself can make you happy. Nothing outside of yourself can make you unhappy. Because you are happiness. You're not happy or unhappy. You are happiness.
Yeah, it's tough though, right?
Swami, as you were saying that though, it is tough, but I'll tell you what
powerful.
Helps.
Yeah,
no one says it's going to be easy, but
I think Yogamurti and I are probably having the same thought right now. But that's
and don't think it's easy for us as well, right? We're sadhus, right? But it's still an upward journey, and it's different levels, there's different stages, and we're all on that journey.
Yeah. I was just going to say, what helps me, it is, you're right, it's so tough. And in the moment, sometimes it's hard to, you know, when you're in the moment, you're in a difficult situation. But when you were talking about control and the fact that you are happy, it reminded me of one of my favorite prasangs from Brahmagupta Samaj's biography. And take it back to 1973. So he had become the guru just a few years prior to that. So he was touring in the Mumbai region. And as we know, his schedule was prearranged from way before. And a devotee from Vadodara in Gujarat comes. So over 400 kilometers away, he comes to him and he says to Swami, Brahmagupta Samaj, and he says, it's my nephew's wedding, because you have to come. The English doesn't do justice to it. He says, tamare avanu che, which is an order. Yeah. Yeah, he's just telling him, it's done, you've decided it. And just that one thing alone, people straight away were like, what? Like, hold on, you don't just walk up to your guru and tell him that he's going to come to your nephew's wedding without even having mentioned it or spoken about it. So so people said, look, his schedule has been prearranged. And he says, no, I've told the niece-to-be's parents and family, I've told the other side that you're going to come to the wedding. So people are like, did you not think, like, he's not your something that you own, like an object of yours. And he says, but, you know, I've told them now you have to, you know. Brahmagupta Samaj said, okay, what date is it? So he's just phenomenal. So he didn't get caught up in any of this. Like, we would all be so frustrated in that moment. Just the audacity, firstly, to do that, to promise someone's time. And then to just come in, order, you know, give an order.
But Swami's engaging with him. He's not
he's trying to make it work. So constructive. He's like, what date is it? So he says, 24th of January. So he gives a date. Swami checks the itinerary. He's supposed to be in a place called Thana at that time. So he says, look.
Where's Thana?
In Mumbai.
It's in Mumbai. Yeah, now, Mumbai, yeah. His visit to Thana had already been delayed twice. So Swami explains, look, we're in Thana on that day and it's already been pushed back twice. He says, but we're coming on Vasant Panchami. So Vasant Panchami back then, I had to look into this. I was like, really curious. And it was around 2 weeks later, just 2 weeks afterwards, he's going to literally come to where you are and, Brahmagupta Samaj, make you happy, right? And he says, no, that won't do. So like, just double down, douse fuel on the fly. Says, that won't do. He says, I've told them all. He goes, okay, tame jano, basically like your problem. I've made the promises. And Swami tried to explain. He said, look, he explained the point around, postpone the visit twice. And the man said, yeah, but I've done this and I've done that. And now you're just going to leave me like this. And my reputation is going to be in tatters. Obviously, anyone would have said, that is your problem. You should have thought of this before you promised. So in that moment, everyone around was just, very frustrated and irate at this person. He wouldn't listen. So in the end, Brahmagupta Samaj, because he always used to say, it means if someone doesn't understand, you have to recognize there are certain situations where the other people won't understand, so you've got to understand yourself. So at that time he said, okay, look, we'll come. So he says, so that, please that person in the moment. But then, again, phenomenal thing that happens here is, he tells Sadhguru Pujya Kothari Swami, who was helping, because Mumbai, that was his, was the senior Swami in Mumbai. So he tells him, so please write a letter of apology to the devotees in Thana, and saying, you know, forgive us that we couldn't come this time, but we'll definitely come again. What, you know, when we talk about control, to have that equilibrium where you have the presence of mind to issue an apology, even though it's not your fault, you don't complain, you don't say, oh, it's not our fault due to circumstances outside of our, you just apologize and you own it. So he showed in that moment how you can absolutely own and control the situation and keep the happiness. Yes. Nobody, I mean, that is such an extreme example. Mm. You are the guru. And the reason I mentioned the point around it was only 2 years after, because when you are relatively new, that's when you're most insecure. Mm. But in this case, clearly he showed that he was absolutely not. He was so in control of himself, his happiness and his emotions. And to me, that's very instructive, inspirational, that example.
And that's, I think you've hit it on the nail with Pramukh Swami Maharaj, Mahan Swami Maharaj. This is one thing that we will see. Very, very secure, irrespective of what's happening around, whether it's insult, success, or failure, they remain equipoised. And I think that Atmagnan is a very strong part of that, which is why, which was very, very interesting, that Pramukh Swami Maharaj in 2004, Pramukh Swami Maharaj was in Gandhinagar, and they were celebrating 50 years of Balmandir. I think 20,000 Bardaks had gathered in Gandhinagar, or 10,000, I can't remember. I was just watching and I was curious, what's Bapa going to tell the Bardaks?
Children,
what's he going to talk to them about? He talked to them about Atmagnan.
Mm-hmm. Children.
It just shows how important it means. And for Swami, it doesn't matter how young you are, or how, maybe we underestimate how kids will receive something like this. But Swaminamam, I think, was very clear that from the beginning you drill this in, and so that they grow up as confident individuals who are very secure if they can identify with this concept that I am Atma.
Wasn't that something, Swami, you were sharing earlier about?
Yeah, there was a very, very nice story someone shared with me that this guy, he must have woken up. He woke up in the middle of the night because his daughter was crying. She must have been about 4 years old. And they tried to quieten her down, couldn't figure out what was wrong. And suddenly this little girl says that I don't want to die. She had probably learned about death. Now, how do you console a four-year-old kid about death? And, you know.
This is a true story, right?
Yeah, it's a true story. Oh, sorry. So it's a true story. Yeah. And so then, you know, the dad goes in and he goes, look, let's just try this. Because Pramukh Swami used to say this, let's do this. And he talked to her and he goes, look, why are you crying? And she goes, I don't want to die. And he goes, yeah, but who are you? Remember what Pramukh Swami Maharaj taught us. Who are you? You know, are you, you know, whatever her name was? Or are you Atma? And she's crying and she goes, Bapa says I'm Atma. And he goes, remember what Pramukh Swami said about the Atma? It's the body that dies, not the Atma. The Atma never dies.
He says this to his four-year-old daughter.
Yeah. Wow. So why are you crying? And that calms her down immediately. And obviously, story ends there. She goes back to sleep and slowly things recover. But what's interesting was 6 years later, she must have been about 10, right? And while he's carrying, you know, she must have fallen asleep downstairs on the sofa. He's carrying her upstairs. And she wakes up and she says to her dad, Dad, I'm awake. So he puts her down and on the steps. And he tells her, he goes, do you remember this step? And she goes, yeah, this is where you talk to me about Atma. I'm thinking that's very powerful, you know, something that we had underestimated, that a four-year-old kid, and you talk to them about Atma, and she's managed to carry that with her for so many years. How powerful that must have been.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's actually incredible.
So I think it also shows that, first of all, obviously, never underestimate children.
And this knowledge, this wisdom, is applicable to
exactly
everyone.
Yeah.
So... we were talking about happiness and how happiness, we are inherently happy. Mm. And we see that in the lives of our gurus as well. I think it's also helpful to take those examples and maybe help us reflect on our day-to-day lives.
Oh, because it's huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Like, so I don't know if the joke, maybe.
Go on.
So, you know,
humorous.
my end up in divorce, actually. So, you know, if once come home maybe and the missus has cooked a bit of food, I sit down to eat it. if I have the first morsel, if it isn't quite, you know, on par, which she normally has, yeah. She's very good normally. If it isn't quite on par, I say, from all Simon is worth the idea.
Okay. That's how you say it.
I was like, missing. She's like, it's like, I just promote something this with you. And she goes, what? Is it too much salt? Too little salt?
But generally, I think it's a very good point that all of us, you're relating what we've learned from the Vajramat, you're relating it, say, to Jivan Charitra. You read Swami's prasangs, and because Pramukh Sai Maharaj's life, the Guru's life, Man Sai Maharaj's life are like the living examples of the Vajramat. It's the Vajramat in practice, in action. And then to make that applicable to ourselves. It's all well and good in a book, and we can talk about it and, you know, give lectures and write book, you know, do podcasts on it. But unless, until we actually try to implement it and apply it in day-to-day scenarios, situations, that's when you see the real worth. And it actually goes back to the very beginning when you said that, you know, we've probably read about this Vajramat, read it several times, but there are so many layers and we keep excavating more deeper meanings from it. And that applies to all of us. You could be a sadhu for 30, 40, 50 years. Every time you come to this any Vajramat, that's the power of Bhagwan Nivani. Yes. This is God talking to us, that depending on our own sadhana, my own journey, it will speak to me wherever I am. What do I need here and now to take the next step? So when I start applying it, we'll have a different meaning. When I've, you know, gotten to the next level, there's still something more for me to improve upon. I can go to the same Vajramat and it'll speak to me in a different way. Like, yeah, you got this far, but yeah, this is next. This is next. And that's why it's so fresh. When you say universal, it applies to people like of all ages, at all levels. You could be an absolute novice on the spiritual path and still find something amazing to apply to your life. And you could be a sadhu for 50 years and still find something that you need to work on.
Which is why when Bhagavan Swaminarayan, you know, asked the Paramahansas, tell me about what you can do. And they all listed all these things, you know, that, oh, if you tell us to stay without food for so many years, we'll stay without food. If you tell us to just extreme cold, we'll tolerate all that. We'll do all these things. You tell us what we'll do. You tell us what you want us to do. And the one line he stops at, he goes, all I need you to do is, mano chaitanya rupa tamaru. You know, just believe yourself to be Atma, separate from the body. That's a starting point.
Yeah, that's actually, it's so fundamental.
That is a starting point.
Your spiritual journey begins from there.
Okay. Because I was going to say, surely that's one of the hardest things to do. So, but is it a journey? You've got to, it's where we need to be. So it's just, you have to start. Mm-hmm. You just have to start.
Taking that first step.
And also this whole, when we say journey, this whole concept of actually believing it and practicing that belief. Nagum Atma Chuj, I am the Atma. It's not a journey of X number of years before we actually come to that realization. It's how strong that Shraddha, that faith is in that belief. And obviously with guidance from the Satpurush.
Again, I think that's the point you were trying to make, right? That Swami, there's so many examples in Pramukh Swami Maharaj's life, Bhujaman Swami Maharaj's life on the Satpurushas previously, where they've shown us in situations, real life situations, of why they've been insulted or, like you said, praised, or maybe they've had things not go their way that maybe you and I would react quite negatively to, but they've kind of shown us, or they have shown us how to behave.
And you know how you mentioned that Maharaj says, you know, when have you tried and you didn't get to see it? And Swarupananda Swami, Sachidananda Swami, Shukmuni Swami, and he says, is it in our hands? Maharaj actually answers that question in Vartal 19. You know when he says, ke Satpurush ne vishe dhrad priti.
Vartal
11. Satpurush ne vishe dhrad priti, ej atma darshan nu sadhan che. The correlation here.
And literally I was thinking the same thing because I heard an extract yesterday. And it's amazing because when he gives the answer in this Vajramat, he is there, but you won't. But the way he does it is so empowering. Because look at his answer: for a person who has attained satsang, realization of his jivatma, does indeed lie in his own hands. So if you cross-reference that to Varta 11, when he says satsang, he means satpurush. Because, but in this Vashtamrat, he talks about it lies in your own hands. So in this Vashtamrat, he's trying to make sure that we're fully empowered and we're ready to do everything we can for ourselves first, not just rely on someone else. It's just, it should blew my mind,
Having the satpurush is a baseline. Now, the efforts are in our hands.
Exactly, yeah. But it's that when you said earlier, he's not a professor, but that is so masterful. It just occurred to me now when I was reading it earlier, I thought that is phenomenal because in the Vashtamrat, he does clearly state that the satpurush is essential, but he's not going to let us off the hook in terms of, look, no. you have to put the effort in.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal.
And I think there's a concept of, right, well, if you put the effort in, this is the other question. If you put the effort, if it's in our hands, ultimately that final step is due to Maharaj and Swami's grace of seeing the Jivatma. Because if it's in our hands, then maybe our ego probably gets inflated. We think we're in control of everything.
Yeah.
And that can have a downward spiral as well, right? So maybe if Maharaj says it's in your hands, so does that mean my successes and failures are solely down to me? Both the up and the down? How do I marry the two, right? If I do try and say I fail, it's in my hands. I have the control.
So are we talking about Atmagnan or just personal endeavors?
I suppose our endeavors towards realizing.
Yeah, there's, I think, no effort will go unrewarded as far as this is concerned. It's like you climb a wall. If you put a ladder up the wrong wall, no matter where you climb, you're not going to get it. Let's just say having the satpurush means you've got the right wall. So now, whatever you climb, you're climbing up the right wall. So every effort is never going to go unrewarded.
Krishna Bhagavan says this in the Gita as well. Nahi kalyan krut kaschit durgatim tato gacchati. So whatever you do along the path of spirituality is not wasted. It helps you some way move towards your goal.
And so, even in daily life, if this whole aspect of Atma-realization and you have confidence, you become fearless, fulfillment, all these things, then logic success and failure won't matter too much to you personally. You'll be able to manage. It's how you manage your successes and failures in life because you have Atma-gnan.
This is such a liberating thought. You are in control now, as you said before. Like your mood is not dependent on anything else outside of you, which you don't have control over, right? What you have control over is yourself, your own Atma. And now everything rests there. Such a liberating thought. You don't have to compare yourself, oh, she's taller, or he's got more muscles, or he's got a bigger house, or she's got a nicer phone. That comparison is gone now. Everything, it's liberating and it's empowering.
Yes, yeah, and I fully agree. I was just interesting, but it requires a lot of self-awareness, right, which is tough because you referenced the Gita there, which is quite interesting because it always strikes me before the Gita is imparted to Arjun is the only warrior out of the hundreds or thousands, who assesses the situation in front of him. He goes out in the middle of the battlefield and sees his family on one side and the family on the other, and he realizes what's going to happen here and what he needs to do. So he had a tremendous level of self-awareness first.
But that self-awareness was very superficial. It's the skin. It's red and green still. He's not seeing the white inside, you see. Fine. That's the point. That's why he's upset. If you see the whole trajectory of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita. So the very first when Arjun actually lays out his situation, like it's like he's having a panic attack. Right, his mouth is dry, his head is spinning, his hairs are on end. He's burning. Classic symptoms of stress of a panic attack.
And that's driven by his self-aware, which is a good. His self-aware, which is a good thing.
Which is driven, So that's what Krishna Bhagavan is trying to address, right? So the very first shloka of the Gita. First of all, it's very interesting because before Bhagavan starts speaking, There's a phrase where Arjun is described. Tushnim babhuva. Arjun fell silent. It's only when humans stop talking that God, are they receptive to God's talking. It's our ego, our own inner noise that's actually drowning out God's voice as well. So when Arjun has laid out himself, like this is, you know, I'm despondent now, in despair. He falls silent, and then Krishna Bhagavan actually starts speaking. And the very first thing he says, and it actually helps understand it, because we're talking about Sukh, and so Krishna Bhagavan is explaining now. He goes, Asochan Anasochastvam. Like, you are mourning something which is not worthy of grief. And then it all, you know, he talks about agatonscha, like things which have gone and coming, right? Nanu sochanti pandita. The wise don't lament all of this because this is immaterial. This is dying. It's transient. So that point about nanu sochanti, don't lament. That's the very beginning of his Updesh. And the very last words that he used, ma shucha, it's the same word, lament, don't lament. There as well, he talks about, this is 18th of the 66, the first.
The first and the last.
So the first word where he actually begins his Updesh, chapter 2, I think it's verse 10 or 11. Nanu shochanti pandita. And then the very last slok that he, in the Gita where he's talking, 1866, chapter 18, number 66. Sarvan dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja aham tva sarvapapebhyo mokshishami ma shucha ma shucha, don't lament. So from the beginning to the end, his entire Updesh, the teachings of the Gita about rising above lament, rising above, and how does he show that? The very first Updesh is, your lament is rooted in this ignorance that this is going to die, this is my relative, this is, you know, this is what's going to make me happy. No, that is not worth grieving about. When he teaches him about the Atma is unborn, it's undying, it doesn't get burnt in fire, doesn't get wet in water, doesn't dry in the wind, all of these things. That's the beginning of the Gita. That's the very first step of spirituality. That you can do everything, but unless you actually do this, you're not going to rise above your lament.
It's such a bird's eye view.
Yeah, it's just like, this is where he's teaching it. And that's the powering thing. That's what's so empowering. It's liberating. It's literally, mokshishami. I'm going to liberate you.
It's quite interesting, because then you, in one way, you think that the niyams that we follow, some of the tougher niyams we follow, Yogamuti, Bhai, and myself.
All of us.
But it's like, we feel sometimes there are burdens upon us or restrictions upon us. I cannot do this, or, you know, also I'm not talking, everyone has a choice, but the niyams saying, you know, they're restrictive niyams, and they are, niyams that bring out the bhakti. So like, your aha, and, you know, etc.
The affirmative.
Exactly. Sorry, what was the word you used?
Affirmative.
Affirmative niyams, yeah. There's affirmative niyams, and then there's restrictive niyams. The restrictive niyams are the ones that hurt a bit more, right? You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't see this, you shouldn't go there, etc., etc. But I think as I've grown older, I think hopefully you agree, I find those niyams actually liberate me. They free me, because I'm not bound by addictions or a need or a necessity to have this certain thing happen or be at this certain thing or taste or try this certain item for me to be happy.
And I think from vajramas like this, if we can actually understand, do it with understanding as well, that what I'm striving after, is it that high from that, you know, that swig or that, you know, experience? Why am I attaching my happiness to something else? When we say liberating, you're literally breaking that bond and finding I can be happy here and now without eating that or seeing that or wearing that or having that or being that. I can be happy here, now, everywhere, all the time.
You know, you mentioned something about a reflection and having the Satpurush as a reflection. Now, talking about somebody who has Atmagnan, Pramukh Sahib Maharaj's entire life, you know, despite all the difficulties or anything that these hardships that he's faced, things that we face on a day-to-day, just make it 100-fold for Bapa. And yet to have remained so equipoised, yet happy, never complaining, you know, never blamed anybody for his problems or anything like that, you know, things that may have come his way. I think that shows so much confidence and responsibility of your own happiness. Mm. That he, you know, in the Jivan Chaitra, there's one prasang in the start where it says that Swami was never one to go around begging for sympathy and empathy from people. He would never go around begging for sympathy or compassion, looking for a shoulder to cry on. He just got on with it. And I think that's such a powerful side of Bapa's Atmanishta or Atmagnan, because he was just so happy within and took responsibility. Look, just move on. So I think reflecting off the Satpurush is his life is a, it shows how practical imbibing Atmagnan is in our lives also. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done it.
Taking that on to a slightly different level, I think that's a very important point that Jagrat Goswami, you point about. The word I liked was responsibility, mm-hmm. right? Now I am responsible for my happiness. I am responsible for, at this moment, if I'm happy or not, the responsibility lies with me. And that's what we call maturity, right? So when there's a child, and you've got, yeah. you know, two young boys, you've got a daughter and a son, children, if you like, who broke this? Oh, it wasn't me, it was Ben, right? You know, like, they're quite easy to defend themselves by blaming somebody else. When you take responsibility, that's sometimes scary. So let me say, Kuzmala talks about Pota Samyajo, look at yourself. Don't blame, if I'm not happy, don't blame anybody or anything else. Now it's my responsibility. And that's, while it may seem scary at first, that moment, the moment you accept that it's, I am responsible, you're in control. You've wrestled control from everything else, and that is such a mature way of looking at things. That's the first step towards a solution. Because now I've realized that, okay, I am unhappy because of X, Y, and Z. I need to move from here to here. That's in my hands. I can do that. I don't have to rely on anybody else. It's within me, literally within me, to do that. And so these teachings are really powerful. They're empowering ourselves on finding happiness, being happy in any situation.
It's so helpful to have tangible examples as well, because I suppose when, if you hear the theory, I mean, it all sounds plausible and it all sounds sensible, but sometimes situationally, like, how do you apply it in that situation? And I think, Swami, as you mentioned, that's where, when we look at the life of our gurus, I've heard the phrase once where the Satpurush is like a mirror. And I guess over time, how I've come to understand that is, like, in the same way as you need a mirror to see yourself physically, when you look at the Satpurush's life,
Maharaj uses that exact word, yeah. actually, in the Vajrayana, Pratham 48, Garuda yeah. section 148, Satsang Darpan Tulya Che.
Darpan Tulya, yeah. And because, you know, we talk about, even in the Vajrayana, Maharaj talks about, okay, who has tried to see the soul and not seen it, but still, when you read that, you think, but how? Like, what am I looking for? I don't know what it looks like. But when you look at the Satpurush situationally, and you see how he operates,
That's your Atma.
That's what I'm going for. I mean, I had this another example, a similar theme to the one you mentioned earlier about the whole donkey example. And this is the beautiful thing about the Satpurush's life. Complete consonance of what he said and what he did. Yeah. Everything was aligned. In 1983, I believe, he was touring in the Ahmedabad region. And it was just during the Shravan month, holy month of Shravan. And some devotees came to him and they said, Swami, in our village or in our local area, there's some other people who are basically publicly on the mic preaching hate towards you and to the sansta. They're speaking bad about you. And Swami said, okay, yeah. And they said, no, but they're doing it every day and they're doing it in public on the mic.
Is this like social media?
This is the exact thing I was thinking about. And I'll tell you, it'll be so relevant. And so, you know, so Bapa says, oh, okay, so what, every day? And you know, it's almost like he's taking interest, but they don't realize what he's doing. And so, yeah, Swami, every day. And he's like, okay, so how about you daily, every day, go to the mandir, get the mic there, and speak about good things, about Bhagwan, do katha and things like that. He goes, take the positive. He goes, if they're that enthusiastic about going out there daily and saying what they say, how about we be enthusiastic about doing what we're supposed to do? He flipped that thing completely over. He didn't ask who it was. He didn't ask what they were saying. He didn't find any need to tell anyone to say, you know, go back and answer them back. He's completely disinterested in that. Again, keeping control of his happiness, but then instructing others like how to control their, you know, because they would have been frustrated. Yeah. So what can they do? I just found that, again, absolutely phenomenal. And can you imagine if people on social media could imbibe that? The whole thing would just go quiet.
Twitter just probably wouldn't exist.
But that point about taking responsibility and not blaming others, that's, you know, very mature approach. It just reminded me recently, it's almost like a joke, actually. I was listening to Mansai Maharaj's Katha one morning, and he shared this prasang, this kind of parable, almost like a guy who's complaining to the doctor that, you know, my wife's, you know, really hard of hearing. You know, her hearing has really, you know, gone down. Like, what can I do for her? So the doctor goes, okay, you know, like, how bad is it? Can she not hear if she, like, from very far away or very close? Because, you know, why don't you try? So he goes, okay. So he went back home and, like, from, like, say, 40 feet away, started shouting, like, hey, what's for dinner tonight? Right? So no response. So he goes a bit closer, like 20 feet, and he goes, what's for dinner tonight? No response, right? So he goes really close, like about 5 feet. What's for dinner tonight? Still no response. Like, literally goes up to Raina's face and, like, shouts in her ear, like, what's for dinner tonight? And his wife goes, this is the fourth time I'm telling you, you know, there's roti shack today, right? So you get it, right? Like, who was the person hard of hearing? It wasn't the wife. It was him. But he thought it was her because he couldn't hear. Look within. That means don't look at finding fault in others or ascribing responsibility to other people, seizing control, looking at yourself. This is at a very, this is when you say pota samejo, look within, at a more kind of exterior point of it. But even at that level, if we could look to ourselves in situations and see, where can I improve? Where can I be the person to you know, accept responsibility? And that makes me, again, in control. That's the moment I begin to improve.
You know how Maharaj says, don't look externally and look internally. What happens is, and we all fall victim of this, we have expectations of everybody around us, which we cannot control. And that's what brings a lot of misery and unhappiness, because we expect people to do things, whether it's family, work, whatever. And it's never to the level that we want it to be. And so that makes us miserable or upset or whatever. The only thing that we can control is within, is our own. We have that control to control our own happiness or the way we perceive things or the way we receive it. And I think that's very interesting how Maharaj says that, because we're always expecting other people to do things externally, except how the only thing we can control is how we receive it. And so I think that's, when you talk about control and responsibility, that's something that resonates very well with this.
I can't change other people.
You can't. Just and expecting having, them to change.
Yeah, it's just, you're setting yourself up for misery. Again, then, now this reminds me of another.
It reminds me of a Prasang of Pramukh Swami, actually.
Go on.
He was in Sarangpur. I remember this because it was the one line that Swami drops at the end is so appropriate. So there must have been someone in Sarangpur who was very anxious about leaving the next day. So at the start of the morning, obviously, everyone goes to Aarti, and he found Pramukh Swami, and he goes, and I might be paraphrasing the prasang here, so please, you know, forgive me. He goes, Swami, I need a car.
Yeah.
Will it be ready? So Swami said, yes, we'll be ready. And about 2 hours later, again, find Swami, goes, Swami, my car will be ready, won't it? And Pramukh Swami goes, yes, it will be ready. Like, this is the arrangement made. It explains to him in full detail. And again, third time, fourth, I can't remember how many times. But the point is, at the end, someone asked Swami, like, did you not get frustrated? Like, we told him the first time, the second time, why would the answer change the fifth time?
It's like, bro, relax, man.
just let me go, him be. And Swami just said, but that's his swabhav. He's going to keep asking. And it's our
job to
accept it. Which was a phenomenal prasang when you realize that, you know, there's obviously this things happens very close to home or in the work environment, etc. And you're right, whether you get agitated or not is up to you.
Yeah. So, yeah, as you said, so how futile is it trying to change everything else outside except yourself, right? There's a nice parable that Pramukh Swami Maharaj used to say in a different way, which I kind of reframe in a modern context, but it's basically about a father. And like he's had a terrible day at work, like everything you can imagine that could go wrong. You know, his boss shouted at him, his computer's hanged, lost all his documents, he spilled coffee on his shirt, etc., whatever, right? Everything's gone wrong. And all he can think about is, because I want to get home and relax in my favorite chair and just read the newspaper. I just want to switch off. So he's coming home.
You said it was modern, Swami.
Huh?
You said it was modern. It's newspaper nowadays.
Oh, sorry. Okay. My iPad, my tablet. Yeah. Shows how much I'm rereading my age now. So he comes home and he's got his young son greeting him lovingly when he comes through the door. And his son goes, Papa, Papa, daddy, let's play. And this, obviously, this man has had a horrendous day at work. All he wants is to sit alone and detox, just unwind. So he goes to his son, go and play outside. Yeah, but it's raining, Swami. Go and play on your Xbox or go and do something, read a book. And the boy wouldn't have it. He goes, no, I want you to play with you. And this guy wanted time alone. So
sounds familiar.
So he's trying to sit in his chair and read his iPad, read his newspaper. But what happens? He goes, look, this boy's not going to give me any peace. So what does he do? In his newspaper, there was some supplement or something. There was a page which had a map of the world. So he tore that page out and ripped it into small pieces and gave it to his son. He goes, Lebeta, right? This is a jigsaw puzzle for you. Go away and put the whole map back together again. And don't come back until, it's all in one place. Like, he thought he bought himself at least an hour or so to read his newspaper in peace and quiet. But lo and behold, in 10 minutes, his son is back. Didn't I tell you not to come back to me? He goes, yeah, but look, it's done. It's no way. How can you put, there's so many small pieces. How could you put the whole map? Who knows where, Vietnam is or Indonesia is, But he saw that the whole map was back intact. He was so impressed. He was Vabeta, you're really smart. You put the whole world back together. He's praising his son, but his son goes, but dad, it actually was very simple. You see, on the other side of the map, there was a picture of a young boy. All I had to do was put that one boy together and the whole world fell into place. So Pramukh Swami Maharaj used to say something similar to this, and he was explaining, here we all are, trying to fix the world, and solve all its problems and put it all back into place. But actually, all we can do and what we need to do is focus on ourselves. One person needs to change. And that person isn't the prime minister or the president or the chancellor of the exchequer or my school teacher. That one person is me. So if every father is a better father, every mother is a better mother, every child is a better child, every employer or employee is a better employer or employee, the whole world becomes a better place. So not expecting others to change, not looking outside for the solution, looking within. I have to be a part of the solution and I can help the world become a better place.
Pramukh Swami Maharaj gave a really nice example to do with expectations. And he said, regardless of where you, what you have externally, external objects, it's like math, there's a sum. Whatever number's at the top of a division, if the number below is zero, then the answer is infinite. So regardless of what you think you have externally, if your expectations are zero, your happiness is infinite. So two people can have infinite happiness regardless of their external circumstances if their expectations are nil.
And conversely, you can have the same amount of objects. One can be absolutely miserable because expectations are so high, and one can be absolutely happy because the expectations are so low.
Higher the expectations, the less the happiness.
Yes.
So I mean, it's quite interesting you mentioned, you say happiness is in our hands and we're in control and we have that responsibility. But I think, just thinking the devil's advocate, there'll be some people who say, well, actually, my circumstances are such where they're quite, quite severe, quite drastic. Things like extreme poverty or perhaps certain issues at home people might be experiencing or, things or ailments that occur within the body, which may not be fully in our control. So how do we close that loop in saying that when managers say we are in control, when there'd be maybe a number of external factors that we may not, you know, we may not be in control of, or we can't stop.
Mm.
And that reaction to that is difficult just to hide away from. Do you see? There a...
No, so you, I think...
Well, I misunderstood.
No, you've kind of answered it yourself, actually. So there are circumstances outside and then our response to it. So extreme poverty or abuse or, you know, physical ailment. These are all things, actually, which when you see the Satpurushas, Jivancharitras, or the Paramahansas who've been through, they've been through extreme poverty, hardship, physical ailment, you know, health issues, like just disapproval, like public disapproval, all those issues, and how they've reacted to that is what the key is. That doesn't mean that, obviously, say you're in an abusive relationship, so for example, that you don't, you know, you keep, you know, sucking it in, right? Being proactive, seeking help, seeking medical advice, whether it's, say, mental health issues, you can actually seek, I know, a mental therapist or whatever, mental health therapist.
Oh, I see what you mean. So it's your choice. You're still in control of how you react to finding a
decision that you make.
Yeah, yeah. So you're still being proactive in that sense as well. Not, again, just shirking responsibility for anybody else. Like, oh, this is it now, and I'm going to have to, you know, tolerate. Even tolerating can be a constructive process if I take that control in myself. Seeking help, and being proactive.
That's actually really interesting. That's really interesting. So then it is applicable to a huge spectrum of people. Yeah.
This is the universality of our spiritual wisdom. You know, it cuts through all borders of race or geography, or, you know, nationality, ethnicity, social rank. It is applicable to me here and now, everywhere and anywhere.
Because Achieve is in everyone.
Mm. Yeah. So there's always some certain thing, so new things to learn from seeing what's wrong. So never feel like, oh, I've read it once. It's not a novel. You know, you can keep going back to it and keep growing and keep engaging with it.
There's so many layers, right? Like you were saying.
Yeah, honestly, I must have read this Vashnamrut so many times, and I know it for Maharaj's description of the ignorant person, but until we, you know, decided to discuss this and thought about it more deeply and listening to all of yourselves, honestly, I could have never come to those thoughts just on my own. So I think it just shows the power of discussing this and actually thinking more deeply and not just taking it on face value, because, yeah, I've never derived all of this from all of those times I read it before.
And the next time we read this, something else will come up,
guaranteed.
Because it's whatever stage of life we're in or what we're going through, it'll relate at that time.
So look, I think that's a really good place to wrap up today. I think it's been a fantastic discussion. I would have never come to so many of those points by myself. So just thank you.
I think that applies to us as well. Like, we're learning from you as well, right? I think that's not just that we're a sadhu, so we know everything. It's these type of discussions that you can have with other people that always bring new insights, new perspectives. So thank you as well.
Thank you, Pujya Paramtat Swami, Pujya Dagana Swami, Sandeep Bhai. Thank you as well.
Thank you.